When my wife and I were first married, I was surprised at how different we were in so many fundamental ways, beginning even with what we liked to eat. Growing up for me as a youngster, it was all about the sugared cereal in the morning. My wife grew up eating 100% whole wheat bread and, well, you know, things that grow, stuff like that. We learned to compromise for our differences, but then it became more difficult when we had kids, particularly the morning when my son put down his spoon at breakfast time and said to my wife, "Mommy, how come daddy cereals have toys and ours don't?" I've since learned that God can use these differences to teach us how to be more faithful believers and how to love. We talked in the kitchen about how different we can be from our spouses, but it goes far beyond food. It can be even much more fundamental than that. Neurologists, those that study our brain, have talked about the differences between the male brain and the female brain. For instance, a female brain can process complex emotional data up to 7 times faster than a male brain. I want you to consider the implications of that. A couple could have a vigorous discussion early in the morning at breakfast time. The wife knows exactly what she thinks and why she thinks that and how she feels. She might say to her husband, "So what are you feeling? What do you think?" He literally may not know until dinner time. So when you look at all of these differences, different families of origin, different ways that we act between genders, even different ways that our brains work, if my design for marriage was to make two people happy, I'm not sure it would be to create a relationship in which two people are so radically different. But if the design is to create a relationship that will teach two people how to love, how to understand, I can't imagine a more brilliant invention of God's than how He has designed marriage. And that's what I want to look at in this session, how marriage is particularly designed to teach us how to love. The spiritual challenge behind this, of course, is that most of us get married not to learn how to love, but to be loved. Isn't that true? Think of your own motivation when you got married. Didn't most of us get married because we were thinking my life will be better with this person than without? And if that's true, that means our primary motivation when all is said and done is really a selfish one. I will be better off if I marry you than if I don't. And so if God's design for marriage is to teach us how to be less selfish, indeed to teach us how to love, you can see how our desires and God's desires might conflict. And until we align ourselves with God's purpose for marriage, we'll not only resent our spouse, we'll ultimately resent marriage itself because it seems designed to put us in these situations where our selfishness is confronted. One of the ways that marriage has pinched my own feet happened to me a couple years ago. I'm a huge fan of college football. I think one of the best ways to spend the fall afternoon is to watch two college teams go at it on the gridiron. But I speak on so many Saturday afternoons in the fall that I don't get to watch nearly as much college football as I would like. But one year there was a huge game that was going to be played on a weekend when I happened to be home. USC was going to play Notre Dame on a Friday night. Both teams were undefeated, and so it looked like the game would have national championship implications. I was so excited about that game, I thought, here God is rewarding me. I've been faithfully serving Him. On my one weekend off, I have one of the biggest games of the year. I was looking forward to that game all week long, planning to eat while I watched it. I planned my whole day around that schedule. Of course, never thought to even mention the game to my wife. Well, just about a half an hour before kickoff, my wife walked into the room with the local newspaper in her hand, which always causes me concern because I've never found too much exciting come out of the local newspaper. And she said to me, "Gear, I was looking in the paper today and I noticed that Fairhaven has an open house tonight." Fairhaven is sort of a funky shopping area in Bellingham where I live. It doesn't really sell anything that you need. It's more of an artsy type of community, like fancy salad tongs and things like that. She said, "They're having an open house tonight, and you know, we haven't spent a lot of time lately because you've been traveling so much. I thought it'd be a great way for us to connect if we would just walk around their open house area." And I really couldn't believe it. I thought, they're open almost every night of the year, and they have to pick the night that Notre Dame is playing USC. But Lisa went on and said, "I just thought it'd be fun to go and look at cute shops." And I gotta be honest with you, when I look at cute shops, USC or Notre Dame, it's not much of a contest for me. But I realized in that instance that this was a call for me to die to what I thought I should get to do. Earlier in my marriage, there would have been a sense of entitlement. I deserve this. I've been working hard. But I've also begun to recognize now that marriage seems particularly designed to really confront that sense of entitlement. I was talking about this with a journalist once when she was kind of pushing up against some of my views on marriage. And so I finally looked at her and I said, you know, I know what your biggest sin is. Her eyes got really big. I thought she was worried I was going to become prophetic or something. And then I said, it's your pride. I know that because that's my biggest sin too. The Bible is very clear about that, as are the Christian classics. I said, doesn't it make sense that God would design the fundamental human relationship, marriage, to confront our fundamental spiritual weakness, which is our pride? And when we begin to look at marriage that way, rather than resent those moments where our pride and our selfishness is challenged, we can recognize this is exactly what God created marriage to do. Now, it took me a long time to get here because, as I said, I married with selfish aims as much as anyone. But regardless of the motivation for why I got married, the Bible is pretty clear about what God calls me to in marriage, particularly as a husband. Paul says in Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And then he defines what that love means. He says, who gave himself up for her. Paul's literally saying that to become a Christian husband is to become a living martyr for our wives, to put their needs ahead of our own. Now, I don't know of any men that ever really get married thinking that I just need to become a better servant, that's why I want to get married. But regardless of why we get married, that's what God designed marriage to teach us to do. And here's what's so wonderful about all of this. When we become more like a servant, we become more like Jesus Christ, who said, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. Now, one of the ways marriage pinches women's feet isn't just to deal with selfishness. It also has a lot to do with disappointment. Particularly when I talk to Christian wives, they can seem so disappointed with their husbands because of all they thought that marriage would be when they're married to a real man who stumbles in many ways. There's just a lot of disappointment with what they really have. Some of this disappointment comes from that soulmate type of thinking. The notion of a soulmate is actually quite ancient. Plato was the first one who surmised that there was some ancient prototypical human being, perfect, who was somehow tragically split in two, leaving the rest of us with a desperate destiny of trying to find that missing piece or we would never be fulfilled. And there's still a lot of people today that live with sort of that platonic type of thinking that there is only one person that we can really be happy with, only one person that can really complete us. And here's what I found when somebody grows up with that soulmate line of thinking. The only way somebody can really determine whether somebody is their soulmate usually comes down to how they feel around them. There's this sense of destiny. They say, I feel a connection that I've never felt with anyone else before. And yet we know how much our feelings can lead us astray. So what happens is they don't take the time to really get to know this person. They don't think about their values. They don't look at their family of origin. They don't go to their family members or their pastors and say, is this a good match? Do you think this is a good fit? They just sense that immediate connection and say, he must be my soulmate. She must be my soulmate. It's a fit. So they rush into marriage, and then marriage becomes far more difficult than they ever thought it would be. And that's when they begin to second guess themselves. They say, maybe this person isn't my soulmate after all, because if they were, well, it wouldn't be so difficult. There often follows an intense period of panic when they think, that must mean my soulmate is still out there. I've got to lose this person before somebody else comes along and steals away my soulmate, or I'll never be happy at all. But here's the challenge. I don't believe that the Bible teaches there's only one person that we can be successfully married to. The Bible seems to be far more pragmatic when it talks about choosing a partner to live this life with. Proverbs 31, written to young men in Israel, telling them how to have a successful life, talking about choosing a wife, says this, a noble and godly wife, who can find? And then it tells young men what to look for. It lists the qualities. This is a woman who will bless you. And it warns men. It says, don't be fooled by appearance. Don't be fooled by charm. That's fleeting. Find a godly woman. It would say there's nothing like being married to a godly woman. And as a man who's so blessed to be married to a godly woman, I would amen that time and time again. When Paul writes to young men in 1 Corinthians 7, he says, if you're engaged to a woman and you're behaving inappropriately toward her, why don't you just marry her? It's not a sin to get married. It's far better to marry her than to act inappropriately sexually toward other women. And Paul would say to widows in that same chapter, look, if you're having a difficult time controlling yourself sexually, why don't you go ahead and get remarried? It's not a sin. Go ahead and do that. Whenever the Bible talks about choosing a marriage partner, it really seems to be pragmatic. It's okay if you can do it. And it urges us to base that decision on character, not some sense of destiny. I'm not suggesting that God can't lead us or guide two people together. I'm just suggesting that that sense of destiny often makes the process more confusing than helpful. There are objective guidelines based on character that we should use when choosing someone to marry, not this difficult to discern sense of destiny. Think about it this way. Does this sound like God to you? That He would base your future happiness and a lifetime of fulfillment on your ability in your mid to early 20s to find the one person out of over 6 billion on the face of this earth with whom you can be successfully and intimately matched for the rest of your life? Do you think God would base your happiness on something that precarious? Does that sound like God to you? Instead of looking for our soulmate, S-O-U-L, I like to talk about soulmates, S-O-L-E. If marriage is about learning to love, it's about learning to walk out the biblical mandate to grow in love. So my soulmate, S-O-L-E, is someone that God gives me to help me grow in love. So how do you know if the person is the right one? Do they try your patience? Do they occasionally get on your nerves? Do they teach you how to forgive and how to ask for forgiveness? If so, they're the one. They fit the bill. They'll teach you how to love as much as anyone. I'd like to begin to bring our time together to an end by telling you a story that really puts us in an entirely new light. Often when I go into a town to speak on sacred marriage, the sessions will begin on a Friday evening, and I'll fly in that day and be a little bit tired from the travel. And they'll have a dinner with a number of couples there that they'd like me to get to know. And I always like it if there's an engaged couple at that dinner, because I found there's a question I can ask an engaged woman, and it'll take her about 10 or 15 minutes to respond, and I can just sort of rest my voice for a while. And the question is this. I'll say, tell me about your husband-to-be. And she's off and running. She says, oh, he's this and he's this. And I so appreciate this about him and I'm so grateful for this. By the time she's done, I love the guy and I'd never met him before. I'm kind of thinking I wish I could steal him for one of my daughters. But then later in the weekend, I'll talk to a woman who's been married for 7 months or 7 years or 27 years. And I might say, well, tell me about your husband. And she'll say something like, well, he's not this. He never does that. I wish I could get him to do this. And I remember going to my hotel room one night and throwing myself down before the Lord and asking this question, God, when does a man go from what he is to what he isn't in a woman's eyes? When does a man stop being defined by everything he is and becomes known primarily what he's not? And the sad answer to that is often marriage. Because of all of the hopes and the idealized notions and the expectations that we pour on this relationship, when we marry a real, breathing person who stumbles in many ways, we can begin to define them by their faults and by what they're not. But there's a young couple from my home state of Washington that gives us an entirely new perspective on love. Brian and Haley grew up in Southwest Washington in the shadow of Mount St. Helens. It's a very rural part of the state, surrounded by tree farms. They got together at a very young age. They were just 15 and 16 when they became an item and eventually became engaged when they were just 18 and 19. Brian had already begun building this wonderful rural home right by the river. It was a cabin that he was building on part of his brother's land. They weren't married yet, they were still engaged, but Brian was working hard to save up what he could to give him the best start possible. That's why he was working the day after Christmas, December 26. Brian had been working on machinery all morning, so his coveralls were coated in grime and grease and in oil. When they broke for lunch, it was pretty cold, so they decided to light a fire in a burn barrel to keep warm while they ate their lunch. But the fire began to get a little bit out of hand, and since they were working on a tree farm, fire is one of the things they feared most. So Brian reached behind him. There were a number of buckets there, and he thought one of them was filled with rainwater, and he thought he would pour that on the fire to douse the flames. Only discovered to his horror that it wasn't rainwater in the bucket, it was gasoline. Brian created a bomb that enveloped his entire body in flames and burned him so severely that he lost 90% of the skin on his body. Doctors were horrified when they looked at him on their table. He was pretty much an open wound, and so they had to go to cadavers or corpses and cut out Post-it-sized patches of skin, which they carefully quilted over what was left of his body to prevent infection from setting in. I say what was left because he was so badly damaged they had to amputate both of his arms and one of his legs. Brian was in a coma for some time, but when he came to, his mom was there in the hospital room, as was his fiancée, Haley. Brian finally got up the courage to ask his mom something that had really been bothering him. He had been blinded in the accident, and so he was concerned, why couldn't he feel his arms? And that's when his mom had to deliver the awful news that his arms had been amputated. And then he asked about one of his legs, and she said, yes, they had to take that off too. At that moment, Brian realized the challenge that lay before him the rest of his life as a blind man with no arms and only one leg. It could have been the deepest and darkest moment of his life, but at exactly that moment, his fiancée Haley leaned over and said to him, Brian, I love you so much. I can't wait to share that cabin by the river with you. And Brian, amazingly, still hadn't lost his sense of humor and said, well, it's going to take me a little longer to build that cabin now. Brian gave Haley an out later on, telling her he didn't expect her to live up to her commitment, but she wouldn't even think of breaking off the marriage. And they were finally wedded 14 months later in February of 1997. I want you to think about what a blind man with no arms and one leg can't do for himself, much less for you in the everyday realities of life. And then, wives, tell me what your husband isn't. Husbands, tell me how your wife disappoints you. See, I think the reason this story moves me so deeply is that if I can be bold, it's my story and it's your story. I was blinded in my sin, as were you. We were crippled by the wrong choices we had made, and yet in the midst of our darkness and despair, our Father leaned over and said, I love you so much, and I'm preparing a home for you that we'll share for all eternity. And having been loved like that, he says to us, and will you love my daughter, or wives, he says to you, will you love my son as I have loved you? I'd like to bring our time to an end by teaching you a prayer. It's designed to confront the question that many of us ask, oftentimes unconsciously, when we wake up and say to ourselves, am I happier today than I was yesterday? If the answer to that is no over a long period of time, we may even begin to question our commitment to that relationship. But I think a much healthier question is in the form of this prayer. Lord, how do I love my spouse today like they've never been loved before and never will be loved again? When the focus is on love, it's amazing how it turns the entire equation of our marriage around. Brian shocked me when he told me that he's had far less bad days after his accident than before. Knowing the depth of his injuries, it amazes me that he could say that. But you know what? That's what happens when we invite God into our life and we invite God into our homes. It doesn't remove our problems, but it gives us strength to face them. And it gives us hope for the future. Teach yourself to say this prayer every day. Lord, how do I love my spouse like they've never been loved and never will be loved?